Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
If we can replicate this, if we can scale this, if we can implement these models in tandem with other incentives and initiatives across cities, we can start to build the cities that we know we need to build.
This week, we investigate the growing trend of urban farming, as reducing the distance between food production and its consumption becomes ever more important to a city's efforts to protect the environment. We're in Portugal to explore how going vertical could help crowded cities and cultivation live together. We skip across the rooftops in New York to see how that rarely used piece of real estate up top could be turning its hand to food production. And we visit one of the farms feeding restaurants in the densely populated city of Kuala Lumpur. All that and more over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. We start today in Lisbon, where a rotating vertical farm system aims to bring fresh produce to dense urban areas. Upfarming is an urban agriculture solution with a remarkably small footprint, both in its physical form and in its environmental impact. Boasting higher yields from lower energy and water consumption, as well as requiring less mileage to get food from farm to fork, this is an idea that is certainly growing in popularity. Gaia Lutz met with the founders of Upfarming at one of their sites to learn more, and she sent us this report.
We're in the middle of Alvalade. We're in between two neighbourhoods that we work with, and we're in a parque hortícola, so in a kitchen garden park. So we're in a setting that we're, you know, in between spaces. So we have right next to us a highway, but we also have, you know, a psychiatric hospital. And so we're in the in-between space, a space that was yet to become, you know, something special. So the setting is pretty much this. There's a couple of trees around. The greenhouse sets in a kind of a greenery scenario with a galvanized steel structure covered with polycarbonate, 1 centimeter thick. And all the towers are made in aluminium, but it's, you know, a wide open space, has the verticality and has like the impact of something closer to a modern cathedral, I would say.
That was architect Tiago Sá Gomes, who I met on a balmy Friday afternoon in a park near Lisbon's airport in the neighborhood of Alvalade. He was busy supervising the finishing touches on his modern cathedral. Inside, 4 aluminium towers stand tall, with horizontal shelves attached to them. To the side lay small shrubs of plants, mainly leafy greens and herbs such as lettuce, spinach, coriander, chard, and basil, that will soon be planted into the shelves. This is the first project of Upfarming, the vertical farming startup Tiago founded with 2 other colleagues. Other Upfarming co-founder, Margarida Villas-Boas, who's taken on this challenge after years of experience in management and fundraising for several international NGOs, is also standing with us in the greenhouse.
Each tower, we're talking about 22 shelves. Each shelf roughly hosts 40 plants, so 800 plants. The problem with kilos is that crops weigh very differently. So right now, the estimations that we have is that each tower will more or less produce 50 to 100 kilos per month. If we're talking about 100 kilos per month, and we think about the World Health Organization intake of greens, which is 80 grams per person, each tower will produce daily servings for 40 people. So that's sort of the numbers. So right here, we have obviously 4 towers, so it's 160 people that will be daily served with their intake of the fresh crops that the World Health Organization is asking us to intake.
With the scientific and technological advances to modern agriculture, the concept of urban farms has taken over many capitals around the world, promising to revolutionize everything from our food supply chains, quality of our crops, and the landscape of our cities. Upfarming touches on all of that. Plus, it utilizes a cost-efficient and low-tech tool brought over by the team from Singapore, which, rather than relying on LED lights, has an inbuilt rotating system to take advantage of Lisbon's privileged sunshine.
Yeah, so it basically works. It's pretty simple. It's not rocket science. So we have a water reservoir on the outside, and we basically use the water that it's pumped from that reservoir to feed both the water pulley system that simply rotates the crops really, really slowly. So we're talking about 5 rotations in summertime, and we're talking about roughly 2 rotations in wintertime, because the whole purpose is to get as much sun as they can. So this water pulley system not only rotates the plants, but also provides the input of water we need to water each and every one of our 22 shelves. So it has a double function, and every water that was neither used in moving the system or watering the plants is basically goes back to the water reservoir and creates, you know, a kind of recycle system that makes us much more efficient than conventional agriculture.
You know, in Portugal right now, we're really facing a severe drought. And in the future, obviously, with the climate crisis, we are really at the front line of water scarcity. So it's one of the big priorities of Portugal right now. And the statistics that we have international, that now we're going to collect our own data once we launch this pilot project, is that this technology saves 90% of the water when compared with traditional farming. So it's really very water efficient, which for a country like Portugal is relevant.
More than just an experiment on sustainable urban agriculture, however, the greenhouse we are standing in is also a social impact project. At its roots, Up Farming wants to invite locals to participate and collaborate in this urban farming revolution. This space, in particular, was built with enough room to host community dinners and events of all kinds that enable residents to reap all the benefits of growing their own food, from the therapeutic to combating loneliness. Its 4 towers also produce enough food so that surplus crops can be sold to nearby markets and restaurants, which in turn makes the greenhouse self-sustainable. It's this well-thought-out social side of the project that has also earned it some public funds through a town hall initiative that aims at supporting small interventions that strengthen the local communities of underserved neighborhoods in Lisbon.
This is part of a mayor initiative called BIPZIP. BIPZIP stands for Priority Intervention Areas, let's say, neighborhoods. So as Tiago was saying, right here, you know, it's a contrasting area. You have neighborhoods that are quite sort of wealthy, but you do have a couple that are more deprived. We're obviously working with those 2 more deprived neighborhoods. In one of the neighborhoods, we'll be mostly working with elderly, an elderly group, so it's all about active aging. On the other group, we're going to be working mostly with women and children, so it will involve working with some unemployed women and obviously doing some activities with schools. It will have different stages. Right now, we need to pilot the technology, see how the crops come out. So there is sort of a pilot stage that will last 4 to 8 weeks. And then it's really organizing these 2 communities in groups, start, you know, defining with them, because we really want to engage them and serve them. So we need to understand what the needs are and create a plan together with the community, which will involve income generation. So the idea is for this project to sort of become self-sustainable. So that's the principle that underlies the whole investment.
As you said, we're seeing a bit of a messy because you're getting built. When is this expected to be up and running?
Hopefully next week. So we're 1 week away to start planting. So we're really excited. It's been a, you know, a long journey of more than 1 year now. And we're in the final touches right now. We're in the final details. We're calibrating the motor. We're ordering the nurseries for the small plants. And it's pretty much it. We have all the earth, coconut choir, all the, you know, natural fertilizers we need here. So it's just about to start.
After leaving the greenhouse in Alvalade, as well as Tiago to his work, Margarida took me to Up Farming's office in Graça, where we met the company's 3rd co-founder, operations director Bruno Lacey. Bruno moved to Lisbon recently from his native London, where he'd already been deeply involved with the city's urban gardening and farming scene.
My background from the UK is in community horticulture and education. So my passion for the past decade has been about teaching people about the natural world, the therapeutic benefits of growing your own food, and how we can develop urban policy that makes cities greener and healthier and more beautiful and biodiverse in a financially sustainable way. And so it was a natural evolution to look at how we could scale up the community gardening movement, which we see growing with great enthusiasm around the world. There's case studies from every corner of the globe about community gardens on rooftops, in brownfield sites, in the cities and on the margins of cities. And that movement has huge potential, and there's very good evidence about the community building benefits that it brings. The food is almost, it's like the medium is the message. The food is what unites people and brings them together, but it's seldom, if ever, a source of revenue. These projects are usually sustained by volunteers and goodwill and donations and volunteering. So the challenge for me is to ask, how can we bring vertical farming, intensive urban agriculture, to make these projects, which are so good for well-being, to make them financially sustainable so that they're investment worthy and they can really scale up. So that was the challenge. And when COVID happened, and it seemed like an ideal opportunity when people were willing to think outside the box and do things that were previously unthinkable, we applied for this funding and were successful.
Although the team was responsible for bringing the technology to this side of the pond, their idea is not to sell these towers. They have bigger ambitions than that. Really, they want to help accelerate the urban farming culture, making it hands-on, accessible to all. Through a concept they call farming as a service, UpFarming installs the towers, as well as offering regular maintenance and a tailored assistance of the cultivation and harvest of the crops to meet the specific needs of their clients, anyone from hospitals to prisons, schools to corporations.
So one of the challenges that we saw is about how the urban food growing movement could be scaled up and made more financially sustainable. And another problem that we saw is that in general, vertical farming is mainly serving, with some notable exceptions, the healthy wealthy, people who can afford very high quality, extremely fresh, niche salads and microgreens. So in most cases at the moment, vertical farming is not serving the majority. It's serving a minority. That will change as technology becomes cheaper and the technologies scale up. However, in the meantime, we believe that we can address both of those challenges with one system, which is our particular incarnation of farming as a service. So instead of selling crops, we enable institutions to grow huge amounts of their own food. We put the farm in the location where it will be consumed, so it's only meters away from the actual kitchen. And as a result, you don't have packaging or transport, and you massively reduce emissions in that way. It also ensures that the crops reach the plate as quickly after harvest as possible. And so the culinary qualities and the nutritional qualities are maximized. So traditionally, one of the reasons why this hasn't been done so far is because the cost of the technology and the capital expenditure is so high that it's very hard to justify the investment when you look at the raw unit economics on 1 kilo of lettuce from the supermarket versus 1 kilo of lettuce from your homegrown vertical farm. But we're not selling lettuces. We're selling participatory vertical farming. We're enabling institutions to grow their own food in a therapeutic and collaborative way in order to improve health and well-being. That's our primary outcome, is communities which are better connected and happier, healthier people with more sustainable and healthy diets. And so that's what we're prototyping at the moment.
From Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Gaia Lutz.
We head now to New York to check in with Brooklyn Grange, a company that operates three of the world's largest rooftop soil farms. Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan recently visited their newest farm on top of a shopping mall in the Brooklyn neighbourhood of Sunset Park. He was shown around by Brooklyn Grange's co-founder and chief operating officer, Anastasia Cole Plakias.
Farming a rooftop is a real estate play as much as anything, and this is a pretty unusual site to walk into en route to a farm. We're in the lobby of a mall. We're looking at a Bed Bath & Beyond marquee and a kiosk selling coal oven pizza.
There's a Captain America statue as well.
That's what we're known for. In fact, it's a landmark on Google Maps. Head over here to this elevator bank.
Even more rustic.
So we just stepped out of a very polished elevator bank with a sliding glass door, and we're looking at a bed of perennials. This is an incredible portion of New York City's Upper Bay. We're looking straight away at the Statue of Liberty. We can see quite a bit of the ports of New Jersey and Staten Island. And then as we make our way down to the west side of the farm, you'll see all of Lower Manhattan and the skyline. It's really quite something. Before we even discuss the roof, it's worth noting that we are on Lenape land. This was an incredibly rich and valuable piece of Lenape earth, and we consider that as we steward and cultivate this section of New York City. So this greenhouse was a huge undertaking for us and our first foray into hydroponic growing. We'd previously grown microgreens in soil in small hoop houses at our other locations, but this greenhouse was a massive investment that we made to increase our year-round growing opportunities. So we do have quite a number of fans in our greenhouse because on a day like today, it's so sunny. It really warms up in here. And of course, the humidity levels tend to rise. So, you know, traditionally hydroponic growing, greenhouse growing is controlled environment agriculture, or CEA. And that's really about controlling the temperature, the humidity level, and your nutrients in your soil or in your hydroponic or aquaponic or aeroponic growing medium. So yeah, again, these are the sounds that you hear when growing in sort of less traditional spaces.
And there's some herbage popping off in here. What are we looking at?
Yeah, so we are surrounded by a sort of tables that are covered in flats of mostly pea shoots. These pea shoots are sold via a retail market. This space used to be filled with microgreens for our restaurant accounts. Microgreens were really a priority for us as we served. Whoop, and here come the fans. Our business used to service about 70% of its harvest, so anywhere between 70 to 80% of our food was being sold to wholesale customers, mostly restaurants, mostly in Manhattan. And that's changed significantly. It started before COVID, but COVID really gave us an opportunity to reinvent our model. So what you don't see in here are 1,000 different types of microgreens, all grown to chef specifications at different heights with different, you know, stages of growth. What you do see is a very efficient pea shoot growing operation for one large retail client, as well as some nasturtium. And then behind these tables, covered in pea shoots on the left, on the right, we've got the first seedlings that will be transplanted into the fields for spring, quite a few onions, as well as, we'll have to walk over there and see what we've got. And then beyond, we've got our germination chambers, or germ chambers, the warm, dark closets where we put trays of seeds to germinate. And even farther, you'll see a sea of hydroponically grown basil being grown in NFT chambers for our hydro nerds out there. And again, that's a crop that's being grown for one retail client, a restaurant. And we're also experimenting as we embark upon a USDA research project on some organic hydro growing practices. Yeah, so we're walking over a bluestone pathway that is actually in and of itself a stormwater management feature. You know, underneath this farm is a traditional roof membrane. We love to install our farms on newish roof membranes. Leak-free is really the critical piece here, you know, spoiler alert, if your roof leaks before you put a green roof on it, it's going to continue to leak after you put a green roof on it. But for the building owner who has just re-roofed their building, you're spending a tremendous amount of money. It's costly financially, but also environmentally to re-roof a building. That's the perfect time to put down a green roof, because the number one cause of damage to your roof membrane is UV rays. And a green roof will protect your roof membrane and extend the life of that membrane by at least 4 times, but nobody really knows how long, because nobody's ever had to rip off and re-roof a properly installed green roof. So we really urge building owners out there to consider, especially if you are re-roofing your building, put a green roof down as you do that. And it's a long-term investment for sure, because green roofs are not cheap to install. But not only is it an investment in your building, but it's also an investment in our environment. Green roofs, you know, one of the reasons that we started farming rooftops is that green roofs have these incredible intrinsic environmental benefits. I talked a bit about actually the reduction of sound, which is maybe not environmental, but social benefit to all of us who live in cities. But the big ones are really that we manage stormwater. New York City and many older cities that have combined sewer systems are plagued by combined sewage overflow, CSO. You know, combined sewer systems are processing rainfall and human sewage use. And in times of heavy rainfall, the systems we have in place are insufficient to process the rain. So we basically are venting untreated wastewater along with rainfall directly into our local waterways. It's an environmental crisis. It is hugely damaging. And green roofs can really help to mitigate this issue by, you know, not completely absorbing all of the rainfall, but by holding it in reserve. The soil itself saturates, but the system underneath our soil, about 12 inches of it on this farm, is layers of drainage material. It can be a cup system, monofilament, small stones, sandwiched between layers of filter fabric. If we can replicate this, if we can scale this, if we can implement these models in tandem with other incentives and initiatives across cities, we can start to build the cities that we know we need to build as we enter into this sort of new climate.
That was Anastasia Koplakius from Brooklyn Grange speaking to Henry Rees Sheridan. Finally, today, we're in Malaysia, where a farm just outside of the country's capital is helping to feed diners in the densely populated city of Kuala Lumpur. The so-called little farm on the hill came from humble beginnings, but they're now organic food specialists, supplying dozens of organic herbs, fruit and vegetables to restaurants and homes throughout the city. To dig out the story, Monocle's Naomi Shu Elegant ventured into the hills to visit the farm, and she brought us this report.
Seven years ago, lifelong urbanites Pete Teo, a musician and filmmaker, and Lisa Ngan, an architect, left the city behind to set up their own organic farm. The husband and wife built their house from scratch and learned to grow crops next to a tropical jungle. Now they have a team of 15 people, plus 4 dogs. And run a literal farm-to-table restaurant for city residents who drive up for a relaxing afternoon surrounded by nature. They regularly supply to fine dining restaurants and bakeries in Kuala Lumpur, and they also plan to launch an artist residency next year. After a tour of the farm, where I admired rows of eggplants and papaya trees, and sampled mint and curry leaves straight from the source, I sat down with Pete and Lisa to learn more.
It's a 6-acre farm. We're certified organic. We specialize on serving the restaurant trade, especially fine dining chefs. So we grow a huge number of crops. For a small farm, we grow between 30 to 40 different types of crops, from edible flowers to your normal supermarket vegetables to herbs, strange things in the jungle, and so on and so forth. We customize a lot for chefs. So it's quite unusual because, you know, most farms our size would have about maybe 4 crops. We have over 30, so that's a lot.
And what is it like being a farm that's, we're only about 40, 50 minutes outside of KL, the urban center. What's it like being so close, and how does that change the way you function or your relationship to the city?
Being like an hour away is crucial, I think, you know, to us as a business, because of course that opens up not just the farming aspects of being able to serve restaurants. The further you are, the harder it is. The logistical chain is harder. So given that we're only an hour away, it makes that quite feasible. It also makes the other aspects of what we do feasible, which is the restaurant bit. I mean, if you're too far out, it's quite hard to get people to come out here to eat. We have very good food here, but it's still the distance. If people have to drive 5 hours, you know, they're not willing to do it. So being sort of between 45 minutes to an hour out makes that feasible. And that makes the commercial financial reality of the farm kind of feasible. You can make a business out of it. Otherwise, it would be impossible, actually.
So in the 7 years since you started this, how have you seen both the restaurant scene in Kale and kind of maybe the people who visit your restaurant itself change?
I think even from when we started to now, there's more and more interest in organic food from consumers. You know, particularly, I suppose, in the pandemic, the last 2 years, lots of people have started growing their own food. There's certainly a lot more interest and a lot more demand, I think, from consumers. And the same thing with the restaurants, actually. You know, more and more people want local produce, are kind of exploring local produce. There's more interest in where your food is coming from, I think, in general.
Can you tell me a bit about your relationship with the chefs? What kind of demands do they have? Do they visit the farm? What kind of things do they look for?
We've always supplied produce to restaurants, actually. We've never really dealt with supermarkets or retail. It's really interesting working with chefs. I think we love working with chefs. They do come and visit. They walk around the farm, you know, and chefs have this tendency to kind of just put anything in their mouth, which is slightly scary. But so at first, I think one of the first chefs that we started working with actually was Darren Teo from Dewakan. So we've had a long relationship with him. You know, lots of the things actually that we thought were weeds, he introduced us to. And actually, you know, it's not a weed, it's edible. So, you know, we work very closely with him.
To hear more, I headed to the 48th floor of a skyscraper in the heart of Kale to visit Dewakan and speak with chef and owner Darren Teo.
So just to put context, a lot of ingredients that we use in this restaurant are foreign really to people who live in the city. And there's this huge disconnect between what grows in the soil in our lands and where we get our food from.
How did you come across a little farm on the hill and what do they supply to you?
I don't know if they found us or we found them, but it was serendipitous. We take from them whatever they have sometimes. When they have roses, we take roses. When they have like old coriander flowers, which are like, or corianders that are not harvested and they've just gone old, we take those. We've taken current tomatoes from them. The relationship that we have with Pete and Lisa is quite dynamic. Pete and Lisa and I, and then also Dewakan and Little Farm on the Hill, because my chef de cuisine, Ling, he manages a lot of the purchases. So what's exciting or what's interesting or what's new or things that we want to try, and the first people we'll call a Little Farm and say, hey, do you have this or can you get this? And then they will say, Pete's told me this before, he said, like, they would say something like, oh my god, the Orkans got a weird order again, you know. Then they'll go into the farm and they'll see like what can be done. My first time up to the farm, they had wood sorrel growing all over the place. They had this wild Chinese beetle growing all over the place. They had purslane growing all over the place. And these were weeds. And I said, hey, like, you know, you can eat this, and you can eat this, and you can eat this. And they had it. And they said, oh, all right, that's interesting. Would you want it? And then they started selling us the weeds that they were growing on the site. I mean, obviously, they took that and they tried to culture it, and they made it more accessible. It's not as wild as it used to be. But yeah, that's really the extent of our relationship. I mean, we've also become very good friends. We share a lot of the same philosophy. We speak a lot. We are entwined, I suppose, as people, more than just a working relationship. And there's this huge amount of mutual respect for not just what they do, but the way they think about it and the way they approach it.
For Pete and Lisa, the knowledge and experience of organic farming is just as important as the food they grow and make.
I think the knowledge, the providence of food, where that food you put in your mouth, you know, where does it come from? I think that's really important. I think in urban situations, you're losing touch with that. And we are a perfect example of that, having been city people all our lives. When we first came to, you know, build the farm, the first thing we had to learn was, of course, how to farm. And that was really interesting because it starts with really small things. I mean, how the relationship between soil and your life it starts right there, actually. And something you don't think about. In the city, you sort of think about dirt rather than soil. I mean, the difference is dirt is not a living thing. A soil is actually a living thing. I mean, it has microbes living in it and so on and so forth. And you begin to understand the importance of having so healthy soil and a healthy ecosystem around the soil. That's really, really central to our understanding and learning in the last few years. And as we entertain more and more city folks, you begin to see that that particular relationship has broken down in the city, and that people feel divorced from the land upon which they live, actually. It's nothing but concrete. So that is really important, I think, going forward. And it goes right down from, you know, your relationship with soil and the things around you and the living things around you.
For Monocle in Kuala Lumpur, I'm Naomi Shu Elegant.
And that's all for this week's edition of The Urbanist. Remember to subscribe to the show for your weekly dose of urbanism every Thursday, as well as new episodes of our sister show, Tall Stories, every Monday. Today's programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David, well, he also edited the show. Now, to play you out this week, here's Foxes with Growing On Me. Thank you for listening, city lovers.